Hey guys, I'm Isla, and I'm your hostess for Wild and Free. In the last episode, we dove into the lives of Leon Leonwood Bean and Chester Greenwood. I have 8 more people that I want to highlight in the next 4 episodes, barring the Thanksgiving special, of course, so let's get to work. Today, we're going to cover the life stories of Robert Edwin Peria and Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. Let's dive in. Robert Peary was born on May 6, 1856 in Gallatin, Pennsylvania, the son of Charles and Mary Peary. However, following his father's death at a young age, his mother brought him to Portland, Maine. She sent him to the prestigious boarding school Loomis Schaff in Windsor, Connecticut. He then attended Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. Once he finished there, he swiftly joined the National Geodetic Survey as a draftsman, making technical drawings. He lived in Fryeburg, Maine during 1878 and 1879. While he lived there, he spent his time taking a profile survey from the top of Fryeburg's Jockey Cap Rock. His 360-degree survey named all of the hills and mountains visible from the top of the rock. In 1881, he joined the U.S. Navy as a civil engineer. He was a scientist, but more than that, an explorer. His work with the Geodetic Survey and the Navy was fulfilling, but Peary was bored. He knew what to do to shake things up a little, though. He had decided long before that he wished to be the first man to reach the North Pole. He began writing a paper that proposed 2 routes to the North Pole. The first was to trek 400 miles from the west coast of Greenland to the east coast. The second was a bit more challenging. He wanted to start from Whale Sound at the top of the known portion of Baffin Bay and trek north to determine if Greenland was an island or if it stretched across the Arctic. In 1886, Peary set out upon the first path. The Navy gave him 6 months' leave, and his mother gave him $500 to book passage north and buy supplies. He set out on a whaler to Greenland, intending to purchase supplies when he got there. He planned to cross Greenland by dog sled on a solo trek. When he reached Gunhau, however, a young Danish official named Christian Maegaard convinced him that he would die if he went alone. Peary listened to the young man and convinced him to go along. Peary and Maegaard set off together and made it 100 miles east before they turned back on account of food shortages. 100 miles. That was the second farthest penetration of Greenland's ice sheet at the time. Peary returned home disappointed, but at least now he knew what he was up against next time he tried. Next year, the Navy put Peary in charge of surveying for the Nicaragua Canal. One hot day, Peary realized his outfit was missing something. He flew to the nearest men's clothing store for a sun hat. Or maybe he'd ripped his socks somewhere in the jungle. No one knows why, but Peary went to the clothing store that day and met Matthew Henson. Matthew Henson was a clerk at the clothing store, and Peary struck up a quick conversation with him. While they were talking, Peary learned that Henson had 6 years of seafaring experience as a cabin boy. Peary immediately offered Henson a job as his valet. Henson accepted the offer. Back on the job, Peary told Henson all about his Arctic dreams. The idea of a frozen, cold world where snow and ice lay as far as the eye can see must have sounded pretty pleasant to Peary and Henson as they toiled in the steaming hot rainforests of Africa. Most people would have been frightened away by Peary's ultimate goals of touring the Arctic again, and again, and again. Henson wasn't scared, though. In years to come, Henson would accompany Peary on every single one of his Arctic expeditions. He was Peary's first man, an invaluable part of the team. For a few years, Peary remained at home. The failure of his first expedition stung, and he was determined to do better next time, determined that there would be a next time. However, there were more important things to do first. In 1888, Robert Peary married Josephine Dybish. Josephine was a business school valedictorian who believed that, although mothering matters, there were other important things that a woman could and should be doing as well. She had started working at the Smithsonian Institute when she was only 19 or 20 years old. She replaced her father there when he became ill and took on his position as a linguist. All fun stuff, and Robert thought so too. He loved Josephine. Unfortunately, his mother didn't share his enthusiasm. She accompanied them on their honeymoon, which is awkward enough, and friction between the two women increased as they moved about the Peary's tiny apartment. At one point, Josephine even told Robert his mother needed to move back to Maine. Of course, that's an excellent idea. Everyone should move to Maine. Robert and Josephine had two children together, Marie Peary and Robert Peary Jr. Peary fell short as a father, though. In his first 23 years of marriage, he spent only 3 of them with his family. That's a bit sad. Anyway, back to the Arctic. In 1891, Peary returned to Greenland, this time attempting the second route he had formerly proposed. He compiled a crew and set off. The party left Brooklyn, New York on June 6, 1891 in the seal hunting ship SS Kite. In July, as the Kite was ramming through layers of ice off the coast, the iron tiller spun around suddenly and broke Peary's lower left leg, snapping both bones between the knee and ankle. They unloaded Peary along with the crew and their supplies at a camp called Red Cliff at the mouth of McCormick Fjord near the northwest end of Englefield Gulf. The local Inuit peoples were curious about the white men who had entered their territory and came to visit. Peary's wife, Josephine, was bothered by their body odor, they didn't bathe, their flea infestations, and their food. However, they were friendly people, and Josephine kept a careful record of her experiences with them. After a winter spent at Red Cliff, the group set off on their journey. Peary found the view from Navy Cliff to be revealing. He discovered once and for all that Peary was an island. That Greenland was an island. Peary made several more expeditions in his lifetime. He is most well known for his claim to have reached the North Pole, which is, in fact, not true. He missed the mark by a lot. People still debate today about that. Some think
he just wanted more fame and recognition. He lied on purpose.
And while others retort,
not true. Peary wasn't perfect, but he wouldn't lie about something that important.
Nobody knows the truth. In any case, Robert Peary was an incredible explorer, and we have learned a lot about the Arctic and the Inuit peoples from his writing. You can still visit Peary's vacation home on Eagle Island in Freeport, Maine today. I've been. It's an incredible house, almost perfectly preserved. You can see a narwhal horn that Peary brought back with him, a ghost in the stairwell, really a hole that you look through. There's a mirror in it, so it seems like someone is looking back at you. It's spooky. A piano that plays by itself, and dozens of curious specimens. There are also trails around the island that you can walk on. It's a beautiful place. Thus ends our tale of Robert E. Peary. I hope you enjoyed it! Quiz time! What do you know about the Arctic? Question number one. Is the Arctic A, a landmass covered with ice and snow, B, a secret international intelligence base disguised with the appearance of being a frozen wasteland, or C, a frozen ocean? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. If you guessed A or B, you were worse than right. You were wrong. The Arctic Ocean is a frozen ocean that houses some of this world's most incredible creatures, such as polar bears, Arctic foxes, narwhals, and more. Question number two. How many people groups make their homes in the Arctic Circle? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The answer to that question is 40. Only about 10% of the Arctic continent is populated, and 40 different people groups live in that 10%. Last question. What animal in the Arctic is known as the sea unicorn? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That was an easy question, so I bet you said narwhal. If you did, you were better than wrong. You were right. Anyhow, on to our next story. Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain was a doer. Anyone who met him would tell you that. How could he not be? Holding the titles of college professor, officer, brigadier general, lieutenant colonel, commander, politician, governor, father, husband, and friend, Joshua Chamberlain could be nothing but a doer. Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain was born in Brewer, Maine on September 8, 1828. His parents were Joshua Chamberlain Sir, or Senior, and Sarah Dupay. He grew up as the oldest of five, and he was said to have been his mother's favorite, while his father was a bit tough on him. As he grew, his mother pressured him to be a preacher. His father, however, wanted him to join the army. Young Josh felt a reluctance at both of these occupations, however. He decided instead to head to college and see where that would take him. He went to a local tutor and professor, William Hyde, for advice. Professor Hyde helped Joshua to enter Bowdoin College in 1848. Joshua flourished in the academic environment at Bowdoin, learning with a will and applying himself to his studies. While at Bowdoin, Joshua met many people who would influence his beliefs and life choices later on, including Harriet Beecher Stowe, author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. He also joined several exclusive groups within the college, including the Pocinian Society, sorry if I pronounced that wrong, folks, the Phi Beta Kappa Academic Honor Society, and the Alpha Delta Phi Fraternity. After about 4 or so years in college, Joshua graduated to great acclaim. It was in this time zone that Joshua met, fell in love with, and married Fanny Adams. They had 5 children together, but only 2 survived past infancy. After marriage, Joshua decided to go back to college, and he studied for 3 years at Bangor Theological Seminary in Bangor, Maine. He then returned to his alma mater, Bowdoin College, this time as a teacher. Joshua began a career as a professor of rhetoric. He was wildly successful and ended up teaching every subject there was to learn, except science and mathematics. He sounds like my kind of guy. He was such a great teacher that the people in charge at Bowdoin decided to appoint him Professor of Modern Languages in 1861. He earned the position well, for he was fluent in 9 other languages than English: Greek, Latin, Spanish, German, French, Italian, Arabic, Hebrew, and Syriac. That's pretty impressive. In the end, however, all of this college education would prove unnecessary, though impressive, and admittedly would come in handy later on in life, when Joshua decided to enlist in the Union Army at the beginning of the American Civil War. When news of the war first reached Maine, Joshua, a stout abolitionist, felt it in his heart that to join the army was the best way to support his personal beliefs. As for those beliefs, most people around Joshua didn't agree with him, at least not entirely. He was encouraged to support the Union from afar, to continue in his successful academic career, and forget about being a soldier. Joshua didn't listen to them. He obtained a leave of absence from his boss, supposedly to study languages in Europe for 2 years. While Joshua would be gone for 2 years or more, Joshua was not going to study languages, especially not in Europe. He enlisted in the Union Army without telling his family and friends, and departed for the gore and glory of the battlefield. Immediately, the Army offered Joshua the colonelcy of the 20th Maine Regiment, but he declined, preferring to start a little lower and learn the whole business first. Joshua became a lieutenant colonel of the regiment under the watchful guidance of Colonel Adalbert Ames. Joshua fought at the Battle of Fredericksburg, the Battle of Cold Harbor, the Second Battle of Petersburg, the Battle of White Oak Road, the Battle of Five Forks, and the Appomattox Campaign. However, he is most well known for his outstanding service at one of the most famous battles of American history. Here is the quote from Wikipedia. On July 2nd, the second day of the battle, Union forces were recovering from initial setbacks and hastily regrouping into defensive positions on a line of hills south of the town. Sensing the momentary vulnerability of the Union forces, the Confederates began an attack against the Union left flank. Chamberlain's brigade, commanded by Colonel Strong Vincent, was sent to defend Little Round Top by the Army's Chief of Engineers, Brigadier General Gouverneur K. Warren. Chamberlain found himself in the 20th Maine at the far left end of the entire Union line. He quickly understood the strategic significance of the small hill and the need for the 20th Maine to hold the Union left at all costs. The men from Maine waited until troops from the 15th Regiment Alabama Infantry, commanded by Colonel William C. Oates, charged up the hill, attempting to flank the Union position. Time and time again, the Confederates struck until the 20th Maine almost doubled back upon itself. With many casualties and ammunition running low, Colonel Chamberlain recognized the dire circumstances and ordered his left wing, which was now looking southeast compared to the rest of the regiment, which was facing west, to initiate a bayonet charge. From his report of the day,
"At that crisis, I ordered the bayonet. The word was enough."
While battlefield conditions make it unlikely that many men heard Chamberlain's order, most historians believe he initiated the charge. The 20th Maine charged down the hill, with the left wing wheeling continually to make the charging line swing like a hinge, thus creating a simultaneous frontal assault and flanking maneuver, capturing 101 of the Confederate soldiers and successfully saving the flank. Chamberlain sustained two slight wounds in the battle, one when a shot hit his sword scabbard and bruised his thigh, and another when his right foot became injured by a spent bullet or a piece of shrapnel. Chamberlain also personally took a Confederate prisoner with his saber during the charge. After initiating the maneuver, he came upon a Confederate officer wielding a revolver who quickly fired, narrowly missing his face. Chamberlain remained steadfast and with his sword at the officer's neck accepted the man's arms and surrender. The pistol Chamberlain captured at Gettysburg can still be seen on display in the Civil War exhibit of the Maine State Museum. For his tenacity at defending Little Round Top, people knew him by the sobriquet Lion of the Round Top. Before the battle, Chamberlain was quite ill, developing malaria and dysentery. Later, due to this illness, he was taken off active duty until he recovered. For this performance, the Union Army presented the Medal of Honor to Joshua. After the war, Joshua was so popular that people practically begged him to take up the position of governor. He served 4 one-year terms as the 32nd governor of Maine. After a while, people didn't like Joshua so much. I mean, he was a great war hero and a smart professor, but he was getting on in years and it just wasn't exciting anymore. He left political office and returned to Bowdoin College once again to become the president. He held the position until 1883 when he decided to retire due to his old war wounds acting up. Joshua died in 1914 as a result of his lingering war wounds. Today, to learn more about him, you can visit the Joshua L. Chamberlain Museum in Brunswick, Maine. Thanks for listening to Wild and Free. I'll see you guys next week.